This is Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. Donald Trump is on the way. He's going to be fundraising here in the Seattle area at the end of the month. Some members of our state's Republican Party say they will not be attending that fundraiser. Hossein Karam is not one of those Republicans. Karam is Iranian-American. He's a Muslim. He lives on the East Side, and he fully supports Trump as the Republican nominee.
We've got to give him a chance. And he won fair and square. So those Republicans who are crying and they don't like him, I think they got to get over it. He was elected by the people, and let's give him the chance to perform.
Well, you were a delegate for Trump at the Republican National Convention. You were obligated to support him then, but as you know, plenty of Republicans, they're not supporting him now, and they've got no obligation to. You can vote how you want. So why do you feel bound to Trump because you were a delegate to him?
He won the election, and he wasn't my first, the second, or third choice. He was the only man standing because he won fair and square. It's our obligation as Republicans, as people who want to see America great again, to support him, and I'm one of those people.
You like that Donald Trump is not tolerant of radical Islam in the United States. But as you know, Hossein, there is the aspect of Trump's comments about Muslims that a lot of American Muslims say is it's defamatory. It's exaggerating what Muslims are like. And it's going to end up making Muslims a scary and unwelcome part of the American fabric to people who listen to Donald Trump. How do you react to that piece of Donald Trump?
I hear you that. You know, let's tell you, I was elected as one of the 41 delegates in Washington State who have the honor to carry the vote, the people. I'm a Muslim. Everybody knew about that. People still voted for me. In our country, we're great enough that our religion is not in the way of who we are and does not make a difference as how we're judged. I do not agree with some of the language that he's using, but he's learning, and I think he's going to be a great president. We just have to give him that chance to put to work what he has earned from We the People, which is his nomination.
Since this Trump fundraiser invitation came out, some Republicans have backed away from it and said, oh, no, I'm not going to be there. I don't support Donald Trump. Does anyone say anything to you privately that, well, look, I can't be associated with Trump right now. It's too hot, but I'm a believer. What do people say to you behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I think they basically say same thing that you're just telling me. Some people may not be supportive of him, and that's fine. That's their choice. If they don't want to be involved, that's fine. There's a lot of other people who want to be involved. I think the bottom line is people have voted. The people have spoken. The voter is always right. They've selected who they think deserves to lead our nation, and we have to honor that. I may disagree with him, and I can opt out. But I do think the vote of the people always is correct, and they voted for Donald Trump, and we got to support him, and we will make this fundraiser happen, and it's going to be better than ever. It's going to be one of the biggest fundraisers, if not the biggest, in the history of our state.
The voters are always correct, really?
Well, the voters are correct, and if they're not, we wouldn't have a republic that we do. In the long run, you have to look at the people vote is what makes our country great like we have been. We live in a republic. Every one of those votes is counted. And at the end, collective decisions of all the people together will make our country great.
Hossein Karam is an apartment developer in Bellevue, and he will be at that Trump fundraiser coming up here in the Seattle area at the end of the month. Now, you heard some Donald Trump yesterday, if you tuned in the morning when we brought you live Trump unveiling his economic plan. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, has been listening to your reaction. Bon, how did listeners respond to that on Facebook?
So I'll skip the posts containing expletives.
Would you?
Yes, I will. Chris wrote to us on Facebook, "This made my morning commute even more gross than it normally is." Gretchen writes, "The racist anti-immigrant remarks aren't even dog whistles anymore." And Matthew finishes with, "No details, just more words, the best words." Love the protesters, though.
Thank you, Bond. Well, like it or not, you got it straight from Trump yesterday. You got to learn about his plan unfiltered, and expletives or no, we like to hear back from you. You can post your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can email us too, record@kuow.org. KUOW 94.9 FM, Seattle. News and information. It is now illegal for Seattle landlords to discriminate against potential tenants based on their source of income. The City Council unanimously passed that law yesterday to help renters who get their income not from a job, but from, say, Social Security or veterans benefits. Also, the city limited move-in deals where you get some kind of rebate if you work for certain companies like Microsoft or Amazon. Reporter Heidi Groover covers City Hall for The Stranger. She says Seattle already banned housing discrimination based on some types of income.
This law goes much farther. It says that landlords cannot discriminate against tenants based on any source of income at all. So if you pay part of your rent using any other type of voucher program or, you know, child support or disability payments or anything like that, a landlord can't say they won't rent to you just because of where you're getting that money to pay your rent.
Why does a landlord care where you're getting your money from?
There are certain stereotypes about whether you'll be able to reliably pay your rent if you're depending on these types of programs. There are also concerns if it's a temporary housing voucher, you're getting some rent assistance for about 3 months, and then you don't find a job, maybe you'll run out of money and you'll no longer be able to pay your rent. And there are also just, you know, deeply ingrained beliefs that for some reason people with more money are going to be better tenants for some reason, and the city is really trying to protect tenants against that kind of discrimination.
Well, you can understand why a landlord would be concerned about that. I would rather rent to somebody with what seems like a long-term source of income than a three-month rent voucher that might expire.
Yeah, that was a concern brought up by landlords through the lobbying group, the Rental Housing Association. And in response, the city is going to do a study in about 18 months to see how the program is going. And if a lot of people are being evicted because they only had temporary vouchers and then they couldn't pay their rent any longer, then the city will come back and change the ordinance to try to do something about that.
The new Seattle law also says no more move-in deals for employees of certain companies. So we're back to landlords thinking they can guess what makes a better tenant and a worse tenant. What's wrong with saying, hey, Amazon, Microsoft workers, you get a deal?
Yeah, I think that what's wrong with that from the perspective of housing advocates is that not only does it just feel bad to favor the people who might already have the most money, but more specifically than that, they worry that it actually has a discriminatory effect because companies like Amazon are predominantly male dominated, especially in their in the tech field, and in some other companies they may be dominated by white workers as well. So the fear is that by favoring employees of certain companies, you might be having a discriminatory effect against the people who don't usually work for those companies.
Well, we're getting to something really important now, because there's an example of, we know, a kind of discrimination that's not okay, but there could be a way to discriminate around the bend in a different way. And it's sure hard to get rid of those gray areas. Do you feel like this law closes all those doors of discrimination?
Well, I'm not sure we'll ever be able to close all of those doors, but I do think it's a good step. You know, the preferred employer discounts, the discounts for workers at companies like Amazon or Microsoft, they might not have been rampant, but they were definitely on Craigslist and other sites. And in a housing market like this, even a few favorable breaks like that can make a difference for people who are struggling or who are competing for those apartments. So it's not, the one answer to all of our housing problems, but I think it's a step in the right direction.
How does this law get enforced? How does the city know what the landlord is really taking into account when it comes to renting?
Well, like a lot of the city's laws, it will be in part based on a complaint process. So, that's an imperfect process, but if people feel they're being discriminated against or they see one of these deals, they can report that to the city. But the city also does testing of housing access. So they've done testing in the past where they actually send people out to apply for apartments, and they sometimes find that people are discriminated against in that application process because of their race or sexual orientation or because of where they get their income to pay the rent. So it's a combination of complaints and testing. It's definitely imperfect, but it's the way the city enforces these types of things.
Reporter Heidi Groover covers City Hall for The Stranger. And in case you'd like to know more about this new renter discrimination law, we're tweeting out a link to Heidi's story about it. There's a link in there to the law itself. The Seattle City Council passed that law unanimously yesterday. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Do you remember this moment during a Bernie Sanders rally in Seattle last year?
We're going to honor all of the Black Lives lost this year, and we're going to honor the fact that I have to fight through all these people to say, my life matters! That I have to get up here in front of a bunch of screaming white racists to say my life
Black Lives Matter activists took over the stage during Sanders' speech, and as you heard, they were met with boos from many of the people in that largely white crowd. All of that prompted a group of white Seattleites to make Black Lives Matter signs, and they'd been going door to door in their North Seattle neighborhoods asking neighbors to put those signs in their yards. Seattle Times columnist Jerry Large says they got mixed reactions. Some people were on board, but others,
they were worried about what other people might think if they put up a sign. Some of them said they didn't really understand what the Black Lives Matter movement was all about or what it was trying to accomplish. Some said they just flat out disagreed with the movement. And one person even said that she was worried that if she put up a sign, that maybe the police wouldn't come if she needed help.
One cafe owner put up a Black Lives Matter sign in his business. What happened there?
Yeah, so in this case, the business owner didn't really think it was going to be that big a deal. And soon after, they got a call from a woman who said she was not going to come to that cafe anymore, not going to buy anything there because that sign was in the window. A few days later, another person came in, a woman who yelled, "All lives matter," and yelled that repeatedly and then yelled, "Blue lives matter, especially blue lives," and then stormed out. So they, you know, kind of surprised that there's that level of disagreement. I mean, they expected to have some conversations about it. But in the end, they decided that because there was so much misunderstanding of the reason for it and so much conflict around it, that they'd keep the sign up.
How's that for a reaction? I wasn't sure I wanted to do it until it turned out terrible, and now I definitely want to do it.
Isn't that something? I mean, they recognize that there was a real point to it. I mean, it wasn't just a nice thing to, you know, saying nicely we support this, that they were really fighting against something.
So you reported on responses to signs, and you got responses from readers. Overall, what did you take away from that?
So there were different categories, but it wasn't really the ones who got nasty, and you know, you do get some of that. That part was not what stuck with me. It was that there were a lot of people who were genuinely uncomfortable with the idea of social disruption by the movement. People who said, "I would support it, except I just can't agree with what they're doing and how they're doing it," or "I support the police, and I don't want to support somebody who doesn't also support the police." So I felt that those were people who could be engaged in conversation about it.
The person who could support the Black Lives Matter movement but doesn't like its tactics, what are the tactics that they're talking about?
One of the things that comes up a lot is the Bernie Sanders speech, where two activists took the microphone, not letting him speak. That was seen as disrespectful, and along with marches that closed down streets or caused others disruptions in people's lives, it felt like that's not a nice way of going about it. But, you know, in social movements, that's kind of, you know, the goal is to get attention to something that's being ignored. And sometimes you have to step up to do that.
Yeah, if that's where you're coming from, is that what you don't want is social disruption and non-niceness, then you might not be the kind of person who puts a sign in their yard on a controversial issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, people get hung up on the fact that this began as a protest against police shootings of unarmed black men. you know, so people begin to dissect the details of each case rather than looking at the overall picture and asking, why is this happening? And I think that's an important thing for people to do. It's not just a matter of random individual cases, but it's a longstanding problem.
What do those negative responses toward Black Lives Matter or ignorant responses, what does this tell you about where Seattle is with issues of race and racism?
Well, it's a difficult topic to discuss. No one likes the idea of feeling that they're out of the loop on it or even racist. I mean, that's one of the worst things that you can say to somebody. So people tend, I think, to avoid the topic. That's made a lot easier because we are very separate. Just like most cities, people don't necessarily come into contact with a wide variety of people on a daily basis, and certainly not having the deep relationships that you need to have to see things from somebody else's perspective. And Seattle is not much different than other cities, but I think Seattle always has had the feeling that it is a different kind of city, and that can sometimes impede progress because people don't see a problem.
We started out talking about yard signs that say Black Lives Matter. What do you want us to understand about the Black Lives Matter movement that we don't?
It's a lot like the civil rights movements of the past in that it involves a lot of different people, a lot of different groups with different ideas of how to go about accomplishing change. I mean, in the civil rights area, you had the NAACP, you had Martin Luther King, you had the Black Panthers, you had the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they disagree with each other on tactics. Should you march or not march? Should you use the courts rather than doing any kind of activity that was going to upset the white community? That's continued into this movement, and it is going to be around for a while, and I think it's going to call attention to this, get people to talk about it the way we're talking about it now, and I hope energize other folks to sit down and make some changes that make a difference.
And is it okay for somebody who's not comfortable with all this conflict to just, I wish you well, but not have a yard sign in their Seattle yard?
Yeah, I don't think you need to have a yard sign, but I think it's really important to pay attention to the issues, to try to educate oneself about those issues and not just assume that you know the answers to them. You know, there's a lot of really important history behind this. There's a lot of stuff going on here that people should be aware of in order to be contributing citizens when it comes to supporting efforts to change disparities.
Seattle Times columnist Jerry Large has been writing about the issue of Black Lives Matter and race and racism in this town, and we're tweeting out a link to his work right now. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. There is a new statue in Celeron, New York, and the mayor is so pleased.
It's amazing. The hair has a red tint. The eyes have a little bit of blue tint. The eyelashes pop. I mean, she's just gorgeous. And when you look at it, it's Lucy.
It's Lucy. This is the new statue of the late comedian Lucille Ball, just unveiled in her hometown. The problem was the old statue. It was kind of wild-eyed, her teeth are bared.
Scary Lucy just didn't look like Lucy.
Well, maybe not. But if Scary Lucy was so bad, why is Scary Lucy staying in Lucille Ball Memorial Park? Could it be that some people are saying, I love Scary Lucy? We'll tell you that story later this afternoon. Join us for KUOW's All Things Considered. Now, let's keep talking about what's on your screens. A few years ago, Delaney Rustin's 12-year-old daughter, Tessa, said she wanted a smartphone. Tessa already had a flip phone. She wanted something newer and cooler. Rustin wanted to know, what boundaries do I set around smartphone use, and how do parents get their teenagers to respect those boundaries? Her search for answers turned into a documentary called Screenagers. So I asked her, isn't making a documentary sort of an extreme way to answer a parenting question?
Well, I've been making documentaries for a long time, actually about mental health issues. And I started recognizing that we were having mental health issues in our house with a lot of tension and anxiety around my daughter who wanted more and more social media and my son who wanted more video games. And as a doctor, I was thinking about the impact of all this screen time on kids everywhere. So I decided to start making a film about it, and in particular to start looking for solutions of helping kids find balance.
You're a doctor yourself, mm-hmm. so you know everything, right? Like you've got your smarty pants yes. parent.
Oh, right. I know everything. Are you kidding? I was struggling as much as any parent I have met, if not more.
What did you learn about gadgets that and kids that you didn't know?
Oh, all of this I didn't know. Before I was feeling, when I started this film project and as a parent, there was so much I didn't know. And you know what was so interesting? I started talking to parents and we were all like struggling. Everyone would tell me, oh, I'm having this problem or that problem. And then I'd say, okay, well, will you be in my documentary? Can I just bring my camera and film? And of course, I didn't know this, but they all said no. And I realized how personal parenting is, that we can talk about kind of our struggles, but when it comes to like saying what our solutions are, we get embarrassed, I think, because we're worried we're going to be judged that we're too strict, not strict enough. So people are really hungry for this information.
In order to tell my kids to limit their phone use, mm-hmm. don't I have to limit my phone use around them?
I think it's really important, of course.
Even though, of course, all my phone uses are highly important. And critical.
Exactly. Well, let's step back. I mean, a way that a family can address this is first and foremost having weekly discussions. No longer to have these reactive in the moment fighting, but to have, we call them Tech Talk Tuesdays, just once a week, a short amount of time talking about why tech is fun, but also where we should have limits. And from there, then making a family agreement. And I think for parents, in terms of rules and setting, you know, finding times that tech should be off. And so that might be for many families like our own, not after bedtime to have it in the room or not to use it in the car so you can have conversations in the car or to put it away, the phone, while you're doing homework and just have tech breaks where you go and check it. Whatever those rules might be, it's also important as parents to, yes, to model, but also to say what we're struggling with. Because I think as parents, we also have times when we don't want to be on our devices. And when we share that with kids and we're not insecure about, hey, I'm trying to do better on this too, then the conversation becomes much more productive and inclusive as a group.
It sounds great. You've got it. It sounds fully formed from you. Sign a contract with your child. I mean, if you haven't done that, you might be pessimistic about this. How do I get this thing going from zero?
Well, first of all, I want to backtrack and say I'm still struggling with my daughter. Okay. It particularly a 14-year-old girl who would love to have her phone 24/7. We still talk about it and we still have tension-filled moments. Absolutely. Starting from zero, I think the first kind of conversation is really just an intake. How is technology working in everyone in the family's life? How much time are they on certain things? And how much time are they doing on other activities? Because that's really what when you get to a healthy amount of screen time, that's how you do it, is to figure out, are you doing any chores? Are you doing sports? And it's kind of shocking when you tally it up for a week. I think what was really heartbreaking for me is to see so many siblings tell me how they don't talk to their sibling anymore. One said, the only time I talk to my brother is when I knock on the door and say, when are you going to be out of the bathroom?
Yeah.
So the downside of not having these conversations and making it work in a more balanced way in our home is huge.
I'm interested in how you are releasing this film. You don't just want people to go out and sit in the theater or go to a film festival. You're licensing this movie for use in community settings. What's that about?
I really believe in the power of film to make social change. That's why I started it. And in all my documentaries, it's been about advocacy, making things better. And I think that screen time right now in our society is an issue all across the spectrum of where kids are spending time, whether that's in a church setting, whether it's at their school, whether it's at their home. Everywhere we're struggling with this. And I really wanted the film to be an instrument to bring all of these stakeholders together in community settings so that we can have the kind of discussions that's going to create, for example, healthy policies in school about tech time, healthy policies in our home. We can only do that if we take these tension-filled interactions we're having in schools and home out of the silos that they've been traditionally happening.
That is Delaney Rustin, Seattle-based filmmaker and doctor. We were talking about her documentary, Screenagers. And you can see some examples of smartphone contracts that other families have created. It's at the Screenagers website. We'll tweet that out to you now, at KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, the Citizens United case. If you care about money in politics, you know what that is. The Supreme Court ruled 6 years ago that corporations can contribute to political campaigns. At the time, President Obama warned that the ruling would open U.S. politics to foreign corporate interests. Well, an investigation at the magazine The Intercept found that might be happening, and one of the examples the reporters use involves our state's former governor, Gary Locke. Reporter Lee Fong found several connections between Locke and a Chinese couple who run a real estate and investment business out of Singapore. The couple's names are Gordon Tong and Serena Chen. Gary Locke knew them before he started working for the federal government, but then after he became Commerce Secretary and then ambassador to China, his relationship with them changed.
According to our interviews with Gordon Tong's brother-in-law, Gary Locke was, quote-unquote, desperate to sell his home, his second house in Bethesda, Maryland, and he was looking for buyers. The house sat on the market for a number of months without any bids, and through his relationship with Wilson Chen, the brother-in-law of Gordon Tong, Gordon Tong's wife, again a Chinese national, decided to purchase Gary Locke's home while he was still the sitting ambassador to China. A few months after that financial transaction, it was about $1.6 million, close to market value. Gary Locke hosted a major real estate investing summit in Beijing at the ambassador's residence. Some of the largest real estate developers in both China and the United States were invited to that summit, along with Gordon Tong's company, which notably is a significantly smaller than the other companies that were invited to this very exclusive summit. After leaving his post as ambassador to China, Gary Locke again became an advisor to Gordon Tong's company. Reportedly, he's helping the company work on real estate deals in the Pacific Northwest.
So Gary Locke has done business with Mr. Tong. Locke sold his house to Tong's wife. If the house price, if the sale price for the house, $1.6 million, is close to market value, what's the problem?
Well, you know, we talked to a number of government ethics experts, folks who have served in the White House, other government ethics experts, and, you know, they found this unusual. We looked through the records. We couldn't find another example of a sitting ambassador making this type of major financial transaction of any type to a significant foreign national of the country they were serving in. That creates the potential for an appearance of a conflict of interest. And
But it doesn't seem like somebody did somebody a big favor if the house sold for what you'd expect the house to sell for.
Sure. Well, Wilson Chen, the brother-in-law of Gary Locke, said that the house was sitting on the market for a number of months without a buyer. So in the sense that Gordon Tong came in and helped, or his family helped buy the house, that was at least some sort of favor. But the story would be certainly much more dramatic if the amount paid was much higher than, but as, you know, as I mentioned a moment ago, the transaction price was close to market value.
Gary Locke has responded to this. His spokesperson said, quote, Mr. Locke complied with government requirements when reporting his home sale. And he really downplayed the connection between Mr. Locke and Mr. Tong, and said that your article made inferences. So if all was done legally, why do you think this connection is something we ought to pay attention to?
This story is primarily a campaign finance story, and it's a story about how there are many channels for well-heeled individuals, for special interest groups, to influence public officials. The crux of our story focuses on how a foreign-owned corporation used the Citizens United decision to give a large campaign contribution to Jeb Bush's super PAC. But there are many ways for powerful interests to use money to win access to public officials. And I think across the board, whether foreign or domestic, this is something that Americans should be aware of the financial transactions that their public officials are doing, especially with interests that may have an agenda or an effort to influence them. And for Gary Locke, holding the very most powerful diplomatic position in Asia, influencing and being America's representative in China, he has to hold the highest ethical standard. And there can't be any conflict of interest or any, at least, appearance of a conflict of interest.
As you've said, the U.S. Supreme Court made that Citizens United ruling 6 years ago, which removed so many restrictions on political spending. Given that decision, what could we do? What are you saying we ought to require of our government?
It's a multifaceted problem. There are many groups that have proposed solutions for the Citizens United issue. One of the ways that we simply found this story was because Gordon Tong's company, APIC, decided to use their direct corporate entity and give to a disclosed super PAC. Many corporations decide to hide their donations, either by setting up phony LLCs in Delaware or Wyoming and giving to super PACs, or giving to what's known as dark money groups, groups that never have to disclose their donors. One simple step is increasing transparency, but a larger, perhaps more long-term solution would be to the law and for the Supreme Court to take up this decision. When the Citizens United decision came down, memorably, Justice Sam Alito shook his head and said no when President Obama warned that the decision would open the floodgates for foreign corporate influence. But here we have the very first concrete evidence that indeed Obama was right. So given this evidence, maybe the Supreme Court should reconsider their decision.
Well, maybe they will. We'll keep following that story. You just heard Lee Fong, investigative reporter for The Intercept, who co-wrote the four-part series on foreign investment in U.S. politics. We reached out to Gary Locke, of course, and he's not giving interviews right now. His spokesperson said the home sale was ethical and legal. Coming up on KUOW's The Record, we're going to talk more about whether money changes us. In 10 minutes, we'll discuss the Seattle business owner who famously raised his employees' wages to $70,000. Is he as selfless as he seemed, and does it matter? Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We all know about famous Civil War battlefields. Did you know that before the U.S. Civil War, there was a different conflict that would have a big impact on the future of the Oregon Territory? Now a series of archaeological investigations is resurrecting the story of the Rogue River Indian War. Here's KUOW's Tom Bonsi.
The Rogue River Indian War was an uprising against miners and settlers in southwest Oregon in the mid-1850s. There were massacres, reprisals, pitched battles, and a final forced expulsion of native tribes from their homelands to distant reservations. Looking back from 160 years later, two things stand out. Artifacts from the mostly forgotten battles lie just beneath the surface. And the human interest in the conflict among descendants and neighbors takes minimal prodding to unearth, too. First, the digging. A team organized by Southern Oregon University just wrapped up a month-long excavation near Gold Beach on the Oregon coast.
Ooh, there's the burn.
The SOU team investigated the former Geisel homestead, where a family of German immigrants were slain or taken hostage by tribal warriors. A few miles away, the archaeologists, led by Professor Mark Tveskov, uncovered the foundations of a crude earthen fort. Here, native forces laid siege to more than 100 settlers and miners for a month until the U.S. Army arrived.
You can see things that you don't see just from the written word, like the desperation of the people in Miner's Fort is not captured in any pioneer memoir. where they crafted a kind of heroic picture of what happened. And here we could see them cowering in a cabin, being rained on by musket balls, burning their wagons and whaleboats to the last piece of hardware, you know, and that's a material record.
The investigators say they were surprised by how many artifacts they found in what is now a privately held pasture. Project archaeologist Chelsea Rose shows me one of her favorites, a broken chunk of imitation cut crystal.
I love these because they're absolutely impractical. They're heavy, they're bulky, they're breakable, they're everything you wouldn't think you'd want inside this fort.
Rose says she can relate to the unknown frontier family who, in their moment of desperation, chose to flee with a cherished leaded glass bowl.
We live in an area that's high fire, so I've had to evacuate twice for fire. And what did I bring? Basically the equivalent of this, like photo albums, paintings, you know, nothing practical.
While the archaeologists and summer field school students work, they receive a steady trickle of visitors bearing questions, stories, or artifacts collected long ago. The cultural resources director for the Siletz tribe visited several times. Robert Kenta says for tribal folks, the history of the Indian War is not that old. His grandmother's father lived through it.
You know, that's very fresh in our family stories, you know, how he, by some miracle, was able to survive the wars as an orphan boy, spending that last winter in a kind of hollowed-out sugar pine snag, you know, just scraping, getting by.
Kenta says it's difficult to be reminded of all the suffering people went through on both sides, but he and other tribal visitors came to support the excavation.
It's part of that reconciling of the past with where we're at today and understanding what your family has been through and your whole community has been through. And in some ways it can help you navigate towards a healthier future.
It's these kinds of reactions that motivate archaeologists Veskoff and Rose.
Everything we do as archaeologists, we're always trying to get back to the people. All these artifacts, you know, they're fun to look at, but really they're a means to an end, and that's to tell us the human story.
Last month, the National Park Service awarded the university nearly $100,000 to survey several more Rogue River Indian War sites and then tie it all together with a National Register of Historic Places nomination. Veskoff hopes that eventually raises the profile of the battlefields and leads to better conservation and interpretation. I'm Tom Bonsi near Gold Beach, Oregon.
Tom put some of his best photos of one of those archaeological digs up at our website, so you can find them by searching Indian Wars at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke, and you're listening to The Record on a cloudy 63-degree August day in Seattle. You know, summer. So here's a little summer reading to go along with that from Book Lust author Nancy Pearl with KUOW's Marcy Silman.
So Nancy Pearl, I'm about to embark on vacation.
Yes.
And I am in search of a really good read. And I'm hoping that you've brought something in that might be it.
I did. And this is a book that was originally published in 2000. It has just been reissued by City Lights, the San Francisco publisher. And it's called The Last Samurai by Helen DeWitt. And I still have my 2000 hardback because I loved it then. And rereading it, I loved it again. It's just one of the best novels that I've ever read. It's one of those novels that demands participation by the reader. I mean, you have to not only buy into the main characters, who are a mother, Sibylla, and her 6-year-old son, Ludo, but you have to buy into all of Ludo's brilliance and his absolute desire to find out who his father was. So the main character is this very, very, you know, no slouch intellectually gifted woman, Sibylla, who had a child, Ludo, who is now 6, who already knows Japanese, Inuit, and Arabic, as well as all of his other accomplishments in mathematics and astronomy, all of which are on display in the novel. And Ludo's mother really refuses to tell him who his father is. And the two of them spend much of their day traveling on the Circle Line in London. That's how they spend their time.
So this is a story of a six-year-old genius, his very brilliant mother, their relationship. It sounds interesting, but what makes it one of those books that you just couldn't put down and couldn't stop thinking of?
You know, I think it's the characters, the way that Sybilla and Ludo are described, the relationship between the two. They spend a lot of evenings at home watching and rewatching The Seven Samurais, Akira Kurosawa's great movie. And from that, Ludo gets the idea that his father is one of seven men. And you watch, we read and participate in as Ludo interviews these various men to try to find out which is his father. You know, it was her first novel. It's one of those classics that very few people have read.
And you think more people should read it?
I absolutely think more people should read it, beginning with you, Marcy.
Okay. The book is called The Last Samurai. And the author is Helen DeWitt. And I guess as I head off to vacation, I'll be thinking about Sybilla and Ludo and the search for Ludo's dad.
You could do much worse.
Thank you, Nancy.
Maybe we just gave you a vacation read with Nancy Pearl and Marcy Silliman there. You can see all of Nancy's book picks at our website, KUOW.org. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Last year, a Seattle business owner named Dan Price slashed his own $1 million salary to pay all his employees $70,000 a year. The CEO of Gravity Payments, Dan Price, was hailed as a folk hero. But the story didn't quite end there. Price's brother, the co-owner of the business, sued him for fraud. Price's ex-wife accused him of physical abuse. Writer Stephen Roderick spent 3 weeks with Dan Price while Price was battling his brother in court. Roderick's profile came out in Esquire magazine with a subtitle asking whether Dan Price is a sinner or a savior. Roderick said he was wary about even writing this profile because Dan Price himself pitched it.
It was one of those things that it's like you almost wondered if there was going to be a hidden camera that was going to come out or something because, you know, there had been a Bloomberg Businessweek story about him probably about 6 months before that. That was not very flattering. And here he was inviting me to come to a trial where he was being sued by his brother, where, as in most trials, a lot of unflattering information was going to come out. So it was really, yeah, I mean, I think that was really what intrigued me, is that here's a guy who either incredibly narcissistic or had some kind of death wish media-wise. And, you know, anytime you meet someone who's that, at least in my line of work, who's that fascinating and seems willing to let you just become part of his life for the 3 weeks of the trial, I kind of jumped at it.
You quoted a former employee as saying, Dan won't care what you write about him just as long as you write about him. Did you actually get that sense from Dan Price?
You know, it's funny. In the immediate aftermath, I think he was sad about the story and wondered if that was really how I saw him. But if any of your listeners follow him on social media, he's tried to spin it in the public eye into this. I learned so much from this guy and from this experience. So even in a situation like this, he's trying to turn lemons into lemonade.
Let's talk about some of those lemons. One of the complicating events was the lawsuit that his brother, Lucas Price, filed. Lucas owned a third of Gravity Payments and sued Dan for not including him in business decisions, including the decision to bump everybody up to $70,000 a year. Also, there's the claim by Dan Price's ex-wife. Did you learn the truth?
No, I mean, that's, you know, as a journalist, this is, you know, this is really, really difficult. And for your listeners who might not know, his ex-wife gave a version of a TED Talk, which was about writing about trauma. And one of the things she mentioned was that she had been assaulted by her husband and been waterboarded by her husband. She's only been married once. So that only left Dan as the person being accused by that. But Christy, his ex-wife, never filed any charges and has not done any interviews and would not talk to me on the record. So, it's a really dicey issue because you want to be respectful to someone's claims and also respectful to someone who says it didn't happen and that there's been no charges filed.
Dan Price has gotten Jesus comparisons with what might be an act of selfless charity, and he's got the Kenny Loggins version of Jesus long hair looks. And he has a religious upbringing. How do you think that played in?
I think it played in a lot. I mean, one of the things he told me is he grew up in an evangelical Christian family where he and his brothers and sister and mother and father got up and read from the Bible an hour and a half at daybreak. And one of the things he told me, we were having a hike through Discovery Park, he said, you know, I always thought I was going to live forever as my religion teaches me, and as I fell away from my religion, I realized maybe I'm not going to, and whatever mark I'm going to make, I'm going to have to make here on earth.
Every good profiler includes memorable anecdotes, and there are a few. Employees buying him a new Tesla, but with a strange air about that whole thing. Then there's the anecdote of him hanging out with Tyra Banks, the next top model host. They're eating fried chicken in her hotel room. It's a good anecdote. What does that add up to for you?
I think it adds up to the fact that, you know, and Dan, you know, some of the stuff that didn't make in the story, he's very interested in becoming, you know, on a reality television show like Shark Tank or one of those Trump-like shows, is that, you know, working for Gravity Payments, which is a credit card processing company, which is not the most sexy business, is not his end-all and be-all. I think he wants to be like an Elon Musk or somebody who, you know, goes and speaks before 1,000 people and they pay him $50,000 and he runs on stage and they all cheer. I think that is a huge component, and I think meeting someone like Tyra Banks and just kind of basking in her fame glory, I think excited him.
We started this conversation, Stephen Roderick, with you wondering, what does he want from me? What did you decide he wanted from you?
I think, you know, as some people I talked to said, no matter what you write, he's going to be happy because you're just talking about him, whether it's good or bad. And I think in the end, he has an insatiable need for people to hear his story and for him to tell his story. You know, his father was a traveling salesman for years, and in some ways, Dan is a salesman.
Well, to some extent, we're all salesmen. We're social animals.
Oh,
you know, look at Facebook, right? So,
yeah, and the thing I would say about that is, you know, the con man was trying to out con the con man, if you know what I mean. You know, Dan thought that he could put one over on me and that I would just be incredibly sympathetic to his take. And I, you know, whatever people think of my work is, I don't really fall for that. And you know, at certain points when I was seeing him try to pull my puppet strings and, you know, read all these stories about me and knew more about me than maybe my mom knows about my professional career, I could tell that he was, you know, trying to subtly move me into a certain place, and I just wouldn't go to that place. And I think that's, you know, I wrote what I saw.
And you concluded headlines are what they are, but you included in the subtitle Sinner or Savior, so let's address that. Where does he fall?
Boy, that's why those headlines are written with a question mark.
Yes.
I think deep down he has Dan Price has the possibility to do a lot of good in this world. To do that, he has to become more concerned with doing good just for good's sake rather than the glamour, fame, and social media hits that it's going to bring him. So I think, you know, he's 32, maybe 33. He still has plenty of time to learn that, but right now he's a work in progress.
Well, this brings me to my main question for you then, Stephen. Dan Price's employees are making a lot more money than they were before in a very expensive city. Why does it matter if Dan Price may do good for reasons other than good's sake? What does it matter if Dan Price is competitive or self-interested?
Well, I think that's a very good question, but it's a question of honesty also. I mean, one of the things that came out of the trial, as Dan liked to put it, was that there was a series of overstatements that he had made in terms of what his company was worth when it was being evaluated. He took a Miss Pakistan to the Philippines on the company credit card. So it's not just that he did these good things, but the way he did them and the way he might have taken advantage of his brother suggests a darker side that, you know, it's like a politician who might support the things that you believe in, but if they're doing it in a kind of, you know, dark way, then you have to ask, well, is the good that they're achieving worth the corners they're cutting?
Is it?
You know, in Dan's case, I think his 120 employees would say yes. I think it's a complex issue that it's up to the readers to read what I saw and come to their own conclusion.
So you can come to your own conclusion because we're tweeting out a link to Stephen Roderick's profile of Gravity Payments CEO Dan Price, now at KUOW. He's the Seattle business owner who got world attention for raising his workers' salaries to a minimum of $70,000 a year. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information.